looked up at me, defiant, and said, "Do you really want to travel with me, witch? Can you bear to be around me, knowing that I know?" But she could not break my composure. I was not the inquisitive child I once had been, not the foolish apprentice or the sharp-edged postulant. During both the broken days of wandering and the times of pleasant stasis, this fear had controlled me. Those days were past. Now I could confront it without flinching. I had pondered for years and learned to admit, if not accept, the truth of the straightness of right angles. A strange series of emotions passed over Elva's face, as my reaction was not what she had expected. Unlike Greta, I had long since mastered my feelings. I said, "You cannot turn me from my purpose. I have braved far more dangerous things than you, as you should know. Now, time is pressing. Come." Elva hugged the bundle of possessions to her chest. "Can you really take us from here?" And she fixed me with a powerful glare that implied, "Now disappoint me, adult. All the others have. Why wouldn't you?" I once more extended my hand. This time, Elva took it. I led her to a wall and pushed aside the layers of fabric to expose the bare stone. "What?" I traced a line on the wall, reached out, and opened a door that wasn't there. On the other side, nighttime. A beach by a black ocean, lit only by stars. So many, many stars. More stars than there should be. Of course I would not take Elva to my home, not yet. But this was a waypoint, a place to build and learn and grow. A place where she could rest her weary mind, free from the painful distraction of other people's needs. She stared into the gap, the impossible portal. No cutting words this time. Solemnbum sauntered into view and peered around the edge of the doorway into Elva's chamber. He twitched his tasseled ears and looked up at me.
"I'm hungry. Did you bring food?"
"Of course. Rabbit this time. Does that meet with your approval?" A sniff.
"It'll do."
He meandered down the beach, out of view. "Do you wish to go?" I asked a final time. Elva squeezed my hand as tightly as she could. She walked through the door, and I followed a half step behind. Chapter 6. Questions and Answers. Eragon lowered the sheaf of pages and stared for a long while into the whirling snow outside the eyrie. Still holding the papers, he stood and descended the long curve of stairs that led to the common area at the base of the stone finger. The dwarves were there eating, and most of the humans as well, but only a few of the elves and none of the Urgals. In a corner, one of the dwarves was playing a bone flute carved with runes, and the deep, thoughtful melody provided a homely accompaniment to the murmur of conversation. The herbalist was sitting by herself next to one of the fires, knitting the brim for a woolen cap made of red and green yarn. She looked up as Eragon approached, but the speed of her clicking needles never slowed or faltered. "I have questions," he said. "Then you have more wisdom than most." He squatted next to her and tapped the pages. "How much of this is true?" Angela laughed a little, and her breath frosted in the cold. "I believe I made that perfectly clear in my preface. It's as true or not true as you want it to be."
"So you made it all up?"
"No," she said, giving him a serious look over her flashing needles. "I did not. Even if I had, there are often lessons worth learning in stories, wouldn't you agree?" Eragon shook his head, bemused and somewhat exasperated. He pulled over a stump they were using for a chair, sat, and stretched his legs out toward the fire. He thought about how Brom would often smoke his pipe in the evenings, and for a moment Aragorn considered getting a pipe of his own. The dwarves would be sure to have one he could use. In a quiet voice, he said, "Why did you have me read this?" "Perhaps because I think there are certain doors you need to walk through." He frowned, frustrated as always with the herbalist's answers. "The keeper of the tower, is he?" "I have nothing to say about him." Aragorn opened his mouth again, and Angela interrupted. "No. Ask other questions if you must, but not about him."
"As you wish."
But Aragorn's suspicions remained. He looked across the common area. Elva was there, sitting and chatting with a group of dwarves, all of whom were attending to her with uncharacteristic animation.
"What you wrote about her, Elva is a bright young woman with a bright future," said Angela, and she gave him an overly bright smile.
"In that case, I should see to it that she has the sort of training that a young person of such great promise ought to have."
"Exactly," said Angela,
seeming both satisfied and relieved. Then she surprised him by saying, "Understand me, Aragorn. It's not that the task is beyond me, but some tasks are best accomplished with more than one set of hands." He nodded. "Of course. Elva is my responsibility, after all.
That she is.
Although you could blame her on Brom, if you want it, for not teaching you the proper forms of the ancient language." Aragorn chuckled, despite himself.
"Perhaps, but blaming the dead for our mistakes never accomplishes much."
The clacking of the herbalist's needles continued at the same steady pace, as she gave him a thoughtful look and said,
"My, you have grown wise in your old age."
"Not really. I'm just trying to avoid making the same mistakes as before."
"One could argue that is the definition of wisdom."
He half smiled. "One could. But just avoiding mistakes isn't enough to make a person wise. Does a turtle that lives alone under a rock for 100 years really learn anything?"
Angela shrugged.
"Does a man who lives alone in a tower for 100 years learn anything?" Aragorn eyed her for a moment.
"Maybe. It depends."
"Even so." He stood and held out the papers toward her. "Here. Keep them. They will serve you better than me. And besides, I have the words in my head already. That's all that really matters."
"I'll make sure they're stored where no one will ever think to look," he said.
He tucked the pages into the front of his jerkin. She smiled. "You do that." Then Aragorn looked back at Elva, and a hint of trepidation stirred within him. He ignored it. Just because something was difficult or uncomfortable didn't mean it wasn't worth doing. "We'll talk later," he said. And Angela made a noncommittal sound. As Aragorn walked across the common area, he reached out with his mind to Saphira, who was outside with Blodgarm and a number of the elves, clearing snow with the fire from her throat.
"You've been listening?" he said.
"Of course, little one."
"I could use your help, I think."
"On my way."
And he felt her turn and head inward. Pleased, Aragorn continued on. The witch child might prove troublesome for him alone, but even she would hesitate to disregard a dragon. Moreover, Aragorn did not believe that the girl would be able to manipulate Saphira with her powers the way she might him. Either way, it would be an interesting experience. As he stopped in front of Elva, she looked up at him with her violet eyes and smiled, wide and sharp-toothed, like a cat before a mouse.
"Greetings, Aragorn," she said.
Part 3. The Worm. Chapter 7. Deadfall.
At long last, spring had come to Mount Angor. Aragorn was outside the main hall, grubbing up roots from several plots of dirt along the edge of the surrounding forest. Once cleared, the plots would be planted with herbs, vegetables, berries, and other useful crops, including cardassweed for the dwarves and humans to smoke, and fireweed to help dragons better digest their food. He'd taken his shirt off and was enjoying the noonday sun on his skin. It was a welcome pleasure amid weather that was still often cold and cloudy. Saphira lounged nearby, basking on a bed of trampled grass. Before he started, she'd raked the plots with her claws to break up the soil, which made the work far easier. With Aragorn were several dwarfs, two male, three female, all from Oryk's clan, the Durmgreist in Jeetum. As they worked, they laughed and sang in their language, and Aragorn sang along with them as best he could. He had been trying to learn something of Dwarvish in his limited spare time. Also the Urgal's even harsher tongue. As the ancient language had taught him, words were power. Sometimes literally, sometimes figuratively, but either way, Aragorn wanted to know and understand everything he could, both for his own benefit and the benefit of those he was now responsible for. A memory came to him then. He was standing in a small meadow near the outskirts of Ellesmere, surrounded by the pine trees sung into graceful shapes by the elves. A treasure trove of flowers lay before him, growing in flowing patterns within that grassy oasis amid the shadowed forest. Bees hummed among the profusion of blossoms, and butterflies flitted about the clearing like petals given flight. Beneath him, his shadow was that of a dragon, flecked with the refracted light from his ruddy scales. And all was right, and all was good. Aragorn shook himself as he returned to the present. Drops of sweat flew from his face. Ever since the Eldonari had opened their minds and shared their memories with him, he'd been experiencing flashes of recollection not his own. The bursts were disorienting, both on account of their unexpectedness and because he had grasped only a small part of the great storehouse of knowledge now packed into his head. To fully master it would be the task of a lifetime. That was okay. Learning was one of Aragorn's chief pleasures, and he still had so much to learn about history, Alagaesia, the dragons, and life in general. That particular memory had come from a dragon named Ivaros, who, as Aragorn thought back, had lost his body in an unseasonably strong thunderstorm before the fall of the riders. The images from outside Ellesmere caused Aragorn to pause and remember his own time in the Elven City. A slight twinge of heart sickness formed in his chest as he thought of Arya, now queen of her people in the ancient forest of Duweldenvarden. They had spoken several times through the scrying mirrors he kept in the hall's eyrie, but both he and she were busy with their duties, and their conversations had been few and far between. Saphira eyed him from underneath hooded lids. Then she snorted, sending a small puff of smoke rolling across the ground. Aragorn smiled and hoisted his pick overhead again. Life was good. Winter had broken. The main hall was finished, with the roof now sealed. More chambers were nearing completion. Three of the formerly mad Eldunari had been moved from the caves below into the Hall of Colors, as a direct result of Elva applying her particular talents. The girl and the herbalist and the weircat had departed 2 weeks previously. While Aragorn was not sorry to see them go, their presence was always somewhat disquieting. He was proud of the time he'd spent with Elva. He had worked with the girl every day since her arrival, training her as Brom and Oromis had trained him. She had also spent long hours with Saphira, Glada, and several of the other, sane, dragons. By the time she and Angela departed, Aragorn could already see a change in her attitude. Elva had appeared calmer and more relaxed, and some of the sting had dissipated from her responses. Aragorn just hoped the improvements would stick. When he'd asked where they intended to go, Angela said, "Oh, to some distant shore, I should think. A place nice and isolated, where we don't have to worry about unwelcome surprises."
Over the past few months, Aragon had done his best to ferret out more answers from the herbalist on a range of subjects, but he might as well have tried to cut through a wall of granite with a twig. She deflected and dissembled and otherwise stymied his efforts with perfect success. The one new thing he had learned was the story of how she and Solombum had first met, and that had made for a most entertaining evening indeed. A strip of pink amid the overturned soil caught Aragon's attention. He lowered his pick and crouched down to see a long banded earthworm feeling its way across the clumps of fragrant earth. "Here now," he said, feeling sorry for having disturbed the worm's home. He put his hand in front of the worm and allowed it to crawl onto his palm. Then he lifted the worm out of the plot, carried it a few feet away, and set it down near a clump of dry grass, where it might burrow back into the ground. Shouts rang out from within the main hall.
"Ebrithil! Ebrithil!"
The elf Aestrith emerged from the shadowed doorway, covered in dirt and dust, a bloody scrape along her right forearm, and a strained expression on her face. The nape of Aragon's neck prickled, old instincts taking hold. He sprinted back to the plot, grabbed the pick, and ran to Aestrith, even as she said,
"The tunnel we were working in collapsed. Two of..."
"Which tunnel?" Aragon asked, hurrying into the hall with her. Behind them, Sephira heaved herself to her feet and lumbered after.
"On the lowest level, the dwarves were trying to reopen a branch tunnel they found yesterday. The ceiling gave way, and two of them are trapped beneath the stones."
"Did you tell Blodgarm?"
"He will meet us there."
Aragon grunted. Together they crossed the main hall and hurried down the stairs and through the door that granted access to the mining tunnels beneath the hold. As the cold underground air hit his skin, Aragon regretted not pausing to grab his shirt. "Oh well." For a few silent minutes, they hurried through the switchback tunnels, descending ever deeper into the side of Mount Angor. Lanterns had been hung on the walls at regular but sparse intervals, and the shadows pooled thick and heavy between them. In the back of his mind, Aragon felt Sephira keeping close watch. She said,
"How can I help?"
He could sense her frustration. The tunnels were too small for a grown dragon like her. "Just stand ready. I may need your strength." As he and Aestrith neared the lower depths of the old mine, angry voices sounded ahead of them, echoing off the bare stone in a confusing chorus. A cloud of dust still clogged the air near the collapsed section, and three separate weir lights hung near the ceiling, providing additional, if unsteady, illumination. Four dwarfs emerged from the haze. Aragon recognized them all. They had been digging through the rubble, stacking the broken pieces of rock on either side of the tunnel as they attempted to excavate their buried brethren. Aestrith pointed at a huge slab of stone that lay across the narrow passageway. Several cracks, straight as an arrow, had split the slab into sections. She said,
"I broke the rock, Ebrithil, so as to lift the pieces away. But if even one part is removed, the rest will settle farther, and I am not strong enough to hold all of them at once."
The lead dwarf, a thick-bearded fellow by the name of Drumgar, nodded.
"She is right, Ugunkarmita. We need your help, and the help of the dragons."
Aragon placed his pick against the wall and closed his eyes for a moment. Reaching out with his mind, he searched for the buried dwarves.
There!
Several feet ahead of him, a single consciousness, faint and faltering like a candle in the wind. Hadn't there been two dwarves trapped in the cave-in? Aragon didn't dare wait any longer. He could feel the life ebbing from the one dwarf. "Stand clear," he said. Aestrith and the dwarves hurried back. Then Aragon drew upon his connection with Sephira and through her upon the Eldunari in the Hall of Colors, and he spoke a single word of power.
"Ryza!"
The word was simple, but his intent was not. And it was intent that guided the execution of a spell. Creaks and groans and shivering screeches rang out through the tunnel as the pile of fallen stone lifted off the ground. The cost in energy was immediate and immense. If not for the strength of the dragons, Aragorn would have passed out and lost control of the spell. Billows of fresh dust choked the air as Aragorn pressed the stones back into the broken ceiling. He coughed despite himself, and then said, "Melfner." At his magic-born command, all the stones he held suspended flowed together, rejoining the surrounding walls, welding themselves back to the bones of Mount Angor. A pulse of heat, hot enough to make Aragorn's cheeks sting and to singe the hairs on his chest, emanated from the now solid casing of rocks. He let out the breath he'd been holding and ended the spell. "Thank you," he said to Saphira, and by extension, the Eldonari. As the dust settled, the wavering illumination of the weirlights revealed the crumpled forms of the two dwarfs lying in the tunnel ahead. Smears of blood surrounded them. Drumgar and the rest of the dwarfs rushed toward their fallen compatriots. Aragorn followed more slowly, still feeling the effects of the weirding he had wrought. Then the dwarves groaned and began to pull at their beards and hair as they filled the mine with their lamentations. Aragorn's heart sank at the sound. Again he reached out with his mind, searching for any sign of life in the two broken bodies. Nothing. Both were dead. Fast as he'd been, he had still failed to save them. Aragorn dropped to his knees, blinking back a sudden upwelling of tears. The names of the two dwarves were Nal and Brimling, and although Aragorn hadn't known them well, he'd seen them about the fire on many a late evening, and they had always been quick with a song or a joke, and generally full of good cheer. Aestrith put a hand on his shoulder, but it was a small comfort. Aragorn bent his head and let the tears fall free. For all the spells he had learned and powers he had gained since becoming a dragon rider, and for all the strength of the dragons, some things were still beyond him. He could lift staggering amounts of stone with a word, but he couldn't turn aside death. No one could. The rest of the day passed in a grey blur. The dwarves took their dead to straighten their limbs, wash their bodies, dress them in fine garments, oil their beards, and otherwise prepare them for interment in tombs of stone, as was the custom of their people. Aragorn helped Blodgarm, who had arrived late to the tunnels, and Aestrith, further secure that branch of the mine, so as to prevent any future collapses. Then, heartsore and tired, he retreated to the eyrie and cast himself down next to Saphira for a restless hour of sleep. He still felt grim, glum, and out of joint when evening arrived. The elves attempted to console him with various high-minded phrases, but their dispassionate reasoning did little to improve his outlook. Nor were the few other humans, including Nasawada's personal envoy, one Marleth Odsfoot, in any better mood. Most of them had labored hard alongside the dwarves throughout the winter, and the loss of Nal and Brimling had affected them even more than Aragorn. Yet Aragorn did not forget his station. He did his duty and walked among the saddened dwarves, murmuring words of encouragement and comfort. Both Hruthmund and Drumgar thanked him, and he promised he would attend the funerals the next day. As the night wore on, Aragorn found himself drawn to the hearth, where the Urgals were gathered. They were loud and boisterous, and though they had no love for the dwarves, their leader, Skargarj, raised his cup in honor of Nal and Brimling, and as a group, the Urgals let loose with a roar that rivaled Saphira's. Later still, when the others had retired, Aragorn remained with the Urgals drinking wreck, which the Urgals made from fermented cattails, while Saphira slumbered in the corner.
"Rider," boomed Skargarj, "you are too sad."
He was a broad, slump-shouldered cull, with long hair that he wore in a braid down his bare back. Even in the depths of winter, he rarely deigned to put on more than a crude vest. Aragorn wasn't inclined to argue.
"You are not wrong," he said, overpronouncing his words.
The massive cull took a swig of wreck from his equally massive cup. Then he beckoned toward another of the Urgals, a stout, somewhat pot-bellied Urgal with a long red scar that slashed sideways across his face.
"Usk, tell our rider a story to settle his liver. Tell him a story of the old times." "In this tongue?"
Usk replied. He grimaced, baring his fangs.
"Yes, in this tongue, Drajel,"
roared Skargaj, and he tossed an empty cask of wreck at the smaller Urgal. The cask bounced off Ursk's horns. He didn't duck or flinch, only grunted, and lowered himself onto the stone floor in front of the fire.
"Give me a drum, then."
At Skargaj's order, one of the Urgals ran off to their quarters and soon returned carrying a small hide drum. Ursk set it between his legs and then paused for a moment with his thick-fingered hands resting atop the hide. He said,
"I must change the words of the Ogralgra to those of your kind, rider. They will not sound as they should, though I have studied how you speak for nigh on 3 winters now."
"I'm sure you will do just fine," said Aragorn.
He'd already noticed that Ursk was more well-spoken than his fellow Urgals. And Aragorn wondered if it was because Ursk had training as a bard or poet. He straightened in his chair and leaned forward, curious to hear what would come forth from the Urgal. In the corner, Saphira cracked open her near eye to reveal a slit of gleaming blue. Skargaj pounded the base of his cup against his leg, splashing wreck across the floor.
"Enough slowness, Ursk. Tell the story. Tell the one of great Kulkaris."
Again, Ursk grunted. He lowered his chin for a moment, and then struck the drum a single echoing blow, and began to speak. Despite the roughness of the Urgal's words, there was a truth to them, Aragorn recognized. And as he listened, he felt transported to another time and place, and the events of Ursk's tale soon seemed as real as the hall itself. Chapter 8. The Worm of Kulkaris.
The day the dragon arrived was a day of death. He came from the north, a shadow upon the wind, soft and silent. He swept across the valley, blotting out the sun with his velvet wings. Where he landed, field and forest went up in flame, drifts of ash choked the streams, beasts fled, and horned also, and the sounds of grief and terror rent the summer air. The dragon was named Vermund the Grim, and he was an old and cruel dragon, canny and the ways of the world. Word of him had come from the north, but never had there been a hint or warning that he had forsaken his lair in those frozen, far-off reaches. And yet, there he was, black as charred bone, with a polished gleam to his fitted scales, and a throat packed full of fire. The youngling Ilgra watched with her friends from beside the spring-fed pool where they so often swam high in the foothills along the eastern side of the valley. From that vantage she saw the dragon ravage their farms with fire and claw and the sweep of his jagged tail. When the warriors of Clan Skogaro attacked with bow and spear and axe, Vermund's flame consumed them, or else he trod upon them, and thus made an end to their ambitions. Even the sharpest blade could not pierce his hide, and the Skogaro had no spellcasters to aid them in battle. As such, they found themselves at the mercy of the dragon, able only to annoy or inconvenience him, but not to stop him. Never that. Like the evil worm he was, Vermund ate every person who came within his reach, male and female, elder and youngling alike. None were spared. Their livestock, too, he ate, corralled them with fences of fire, and feasted upon the helpless animals until his chops were clotted with gore and the ground a crimson shambles. All that and more Ilgra saw. She could do nothing to help, so she stayed by the pool, though to wait hurt as much as any wound. Those of her friends who weren't so wise ran to join the fray, and of their number, many were lost. As the dragon approached the hall of her family, Ilgra bared her teeth in a helpless snarl. Closer it came, and then closer still, and then, with a slow-moving swipe, the scaled monster crushed her home. A howl tore from Ilgra's throat, and she sank to her knees and grasped the tips of her horns. Relief tempered her anguish as she saw her mother scramble free of the wreckage, and with her, Ilgra's younger sister, Yana. But it was a fleeting relief, for Vermund's head descended toward them, his heated maw parted. From across the fields came sprinting Ilgra's father, spear held high. The lightness of hope filled her heart. Her father was first among the anointed. Few there were who could match his might, and though he was small compared with the dragon, she knew his courage was equal to that of the gods. 4 winters ago a hungry cave bear had come prowling down from the mountains, and her father had faced it with nothing more than a knife in one hand and a cudgel in the other, and he had slain the bear, killing it with a slash to the flank and a hard blow to the head. The skull of the beast had hung over their hearth ever since. Of everyone in Clan Skagaro, Ilgra felt sure he could stop Vermund the Grim. Even through the tumult, Ilgra heard her father shout challenges at the dreadful dragon, and curses too. With slithering quickness, Vermund turned to face him. Undaunted, her father darted past the worm's plough-shaped chin and drove his spear at a gap between the scales on Vermund's plated neck. The blade missed, and a sound as of metal striking stone reached Ilgra from the valley floor. Chills of mortal fear crawled along her limbs as Vermund uttered a thunderous chuckle strong enough to shake the earth. The dragon's amusement angered her, and she gnashed her teeth, outraged. How dare it laugh at their misery? To the last, a warrior, her father loosed a cry and ran between Vermund's legs, where it was difficult for the dragon to reach. But the creature reared back and filled the mighty bellows of his lungs, and Ilgra howled again as a torrent of blue-fringed fire engulfed her father. Then the heaviness of despair crushed Ilgra's heart, and tears welled from her eyes. Her father's sacrifice was not in vain, though. While he had distracted Vermund, her mother and sister fled the dragon, and by the blessing of Rana the Huntress, Vermund showed no interest in following, but concentrated instead upon their herds. With all the clan dead or scattered, Vermund was free to feast at his leisure. Ilgra remained sitting on the ground, and she wept as she watched. Survivors joined her in ragged groups, their clothes scorched and torn, and some bearing fearsome wounds. Together they huddled behind rock and ridge, silent as rabbits before a seeking snake. Fires spread across the valley, ranks of trees, gnarled old pines hundreds of feet tall, exploded in pillars of orange and yellow. The sound echoed among the peaks.
Tails of twisting embers streamed skyward as the inferno climbed the flanks of the mountains. Billows of smoke fouled the air, and ash fell thick as snow until a false twilight blanketed the valley, a dark shroud of destruction, heavy with grief, bitter with anger. Vermund gorged himself upon their sheep and goats and pigs until his belly hung round and firm, pregnant with his gluttony. When, finally, he was sated, the dragon hove himself into the dismal sky. He flew no great distance, though, whether because of his belly or because livestock yet remained to eat, Ilgra knew not. But the murderous old worm travelled no farther than the head of the valley. There he alighted upon the tallest mountain, high, snow-clad Kulkaris. He wrapped himself about its jagged peak, tucked his snout under his tail, and with a final, fiery sigh, closed his eyes. Thus he slept, and while he slept, he stirred no more. Ilgra stared through the smoke toward his dark and distant bulk. A pestilential tumor mounted atop Kulkaris. As the cold constriction of hate tightened round her heart, Ilgra swore the most terrible oath she knew, for she had but one purpose now, to kill Vermund the Grim, to kill the Worm of Kulkaris. When last they deemed it safe, those who remained of Clan Skagaro gathered in the south of the valley at the Hall of Jar, who tended the fish traps. Ilgra sat in a shadowed corner of the hall, chewing on her silence, while the circle of old dams, the Herndal, debated what best to do. First, they chose a war chief from among the males who yet lived, Arvog, the biggest, strongest, and fastest of them all. He was anointed, as had been Ilgra's father, and he towered over those who were not. But anointed or no, Arvog bided upon the wisdom of the dams, and it was they who decided their course. The clan stayed huddled in Jar's hall for a full 3 days, until they began to think that perhaps Vermund would not return. With the cruel tax of his hunger paid, and more besides, perhaps the worm had lost interest in those who had escaped. Perhaps. While they waited, they sang the death songs for their fallen clanmates, and made offerings at the shrine of Jar to each of the gods, but most especially to Svarvok, king of the gods. For now, more than ever, they needed his strength. Ilgra sang alongside her mother and sister, sang until she was a husk, emptied of all but her voice, and together they mourned their loss. At close of the 3rd day, the braver clan members returned to the village under cover of darkness to gather supplies and search for any wounded. They found but one, Darvek the Carver, who had lost 2 of his fingers, but otherwise still had use of his hands. 4 more days the clan held fast. In that time, Vermund showed no sign of movement. If not for the occasional puff of smoke that drifted from his nostrils, he might as well have been dead. Nevertheless, the clan prepared to again face the dragon. Under Arvog's direction, they made spears from saplings, and arrows from dogwood, boiled leather for armor, and honed their blades. Ilgra took to the warlike preparations with enthusiasm, determined to do all she could to help defeat the dragon. For the Herndal had decided they would stay. The valley was theirs, and Vermund an intruder deserving of death. All their belongings lay in that narrow mountain cleft under the shadow of Kulkaris. Moreover, were they to leave, they would soon trespass on the territory of rival clans,
and with their numbers so diminished, the Skagaro had little hope of winning new territory by force of arms. Vermund, too, they could not hope to defeat in open battle, but much was said around the hall fire about tricks and traps, and a sense of reckless optimism spread. The most likely way to kill the dragon, they agreed, would be to climb Kulkaris and stab him through the eye while he lay dreaming. First, though, the dead needed reclaiming. Without the proper rites, their spirits would not find the rest they deserved, and none of the Skagaro were willing to risk being cursed by those Vermund had slain. Nor was fear their only spur, but sorrow and respect also. "We must move with haste," said Arvog, "so we may strike at Vermund ere he wakes." Ilgra decided then to join the party that would retrieve the bodies. The thought of her father's remains, if remains there were, lying in an open field, where the birds and beasts might pick at them, bothered her more than she could say. It was a deep wrongness, one she intended to correct. From the store of weapons she chose a spear, and she washed the blade with her blood, and named it Gorgoth, or Revenge. Her mother objected, said that Ilgra was still too young. "You have not yet reached the age of the Ushthim, and you have not passed your trials. Wait, and leave this to those who have already proven their strength." But Ilgra rebelled. "No, I have my horns. I will not sit and cower while others venture forth." So she broke from her mother and went to stand with Arvog's warband by the fire. They did not turn her away, but welcomed her into their fold, for their numbers were small, and they needed all who were willing to help. On the morning of the eighth day, Ilgra accompanied Arvog and the rest of the warband as they crept back to the smoldering ruins of their village. The fires had died down in the fields and the foothills, leaving the land scorched black. Many of the buildings still stood, though few, without damage. Some had torn thatching, others a crushed wall or a broken beam, and everything sooty and stinking of smoke. Finding their dead amid the devastation was no easy task. They worked in teams to sort through the rubble and scour the trampled earth, and many a grisly discovery they made. A smear of blood, a shard of bone, parts of loved ones left behind, where the murderous dragon had been careless in his eating. Often it was impossible to attach a name to the parts, so Arvog had them gathered in the center of the village, and there the warband built them a proper pyre. Ilgra labored alongside the others for half a day, silent, except for when answering the occasional question or order. When last they broke to rest, she rested not, but went to the wreckage of her family's hall. There, by the pile of blistered beams, Ilgra came upon what was left of her father, a twisted, nearly unrecognizable shape, charred black by dragon fire. Grief and rage, equally strong and equally terrible, stabbed her heart, and she knelt beside him and wept. All her life, her father had protected their family, yet at the deciding moment when the foul worm had threatened, she had not been able to protect him. It was a failure Ilgra could never correct, and she knew it would haunt her all her years. Though singed and discolored, her father's left horn was yet intact. When Ilgra could bring herself to move, she cut it from his head, chanting to the gods as she did, in the hope her prayers would smooth his way to the afterlife. Then she gathered up his corpse and carried it to the pyre in the center of the village. The weight of her father's body in her arms was not something that Ilgra soon forgot. Their wretched search continued late into the evening, until they were well sure they had found every last piece of battered flesh belonging to their clanmates, and placed them with grieving reverence upon the pyre. Then Ilgra and the rest of the warband performed the required rituals, and Arvag lit the tower of stacked wood. It was a funeral fit for the bravest of warriors, and all the dead were warriors, even the younglings. The hated dragon had killed them in battle. They deserved the same consideration as any of the Horned who died while raiding or wrestling or otherwise attempting to win honor for their name. As the pyre blazed bright, Arvag strode forth, bared his throat to the great mountain Kulkaris and to Vermund atop, and bellowed so loudly that his cry echoed the length of the valley. Others joined in, and Ilgra too, until they all stood facing the mountain, shouting their challenges through throats torn raw. It was a foolish, futile gesture that risked rousing the dragon's wrath, but they did not care. The noise frightened a flock of ravens from the trees. If the sound troubled Vermund in his slumber, it did not show. He seemed entirely oblivious, or worse, uncaring, toward the valley below. The warband kept vigil around the pyre while it burned, and when night fell, they made camp on the cold earth. Ilgra could not bring herself to sleep, so she stood watch beside the pillar of flames, gripping her spear and glaring at the strip of inky darkness wrapped tight around the peak of Kulkaris. Stars still glimmered in the sky, and the first hint of grey light had just appeared above the eastern mountains, when Arvag and six other warriors set out to climb Kulkaris and kill the dragon Vermund. Ilgra begged to go with them, to quench her thirst for vengeance. But Arvag refused, said she was too young, too inexperienced. "We have but one chance to catch the worm unawares." And Ilgra hated that he was right. Then he said, "Worry not, Ilgra. With Svarvok's favor, you shall have your fill of blood today. All our clan shall." This Ilgra accepted, but it sat badly with her. Young she was, and untested also, but the anger that burned in her belly had no match, and she felt herself equal in spirit, if not stature, with the mightiest of the Horned. With Arvag at the lead, the seven warriors departed. Ilgra and the rest of the warband watched in silence from beside the grave of coals. It had been agreed that midday was the best time to strike at Vermund. Dragons, like the great mountain cats, were known to do most of their hunting in the early mornings and late evenings. When the sun was at its highest, Vermund was likely to be in the deepest part of his sleep, and thus the most vulnerable. If ever a dragon the size of Vermund could be described as vulnerable. Kulkaris was a formidable mountain, and though the Horned of Clan Skagara was strong and hardy, reaching the peak was far from easy. The way was treacherous, full of steep ascents, narrow ridges, and slopes strewn with loose rock. Rare it was any of the Skagaro sought to gain the crown of High Kulkaris unless driven by vision or honor or madness. In all Ilgra's life, only one of the clan had attempted it, a young warrior by the name of Narvag, who had meant to prove himself by the feat when he could not prove himself by strength of arms. But Narvag had failed in his attempt, and shamed, exiled himself from the valley. Since then, he had been seen no more. While they waited, Ilgra and her companions sorted through the rubble for needed tools and prized possessions. The day was bleak and overcast, and rain came down upon them in fitful sweeps. A chill crept into Ilgra's bones. She sat crouched in the lee of a feed shed and pulled her wolfskin cloak tight around her shoulders. As always, her gaze turned to Kulkaris and to Vermund thereupon. But no sign of Arvog or his band could she see, nor did any cry or clash reach her straining ears. The day wore on. Near midday, one of Ildra's companions, Jarzek, claimed to hear a sound from the mountaintop, a crack or a shout of some kind. But none of the others in the ruined village heard it, and Ildra was doubtful. Soon after, she spotted what appeared to be a puff of smoke rising from Kulkaris, but after studying it, she decided the haze was actually a scrap of wind-blown cloud. As the sun started toward the jagged horizon, it seemed clear that Arvog's group had either been delayed in their purpose or had failed entirely. Dispirited, Ilgra and the others gathered around the remnants of the pyre. There they sat, hunched and unspeaking, while dusk settled over the valley. The hollow moon had just peeked over the mountains when they heard footsteps approaching. Down the path to Kulkaris came four of the seven who had departed. All were smeared with dirt and blood, and they appeared heartsick, footsore, and hungry. Arvag and another of the anointed carried one of the Skagaro, who looked to have a broken ankle, while Arvag himself bore a deep gash above his brow. Ilgra approved of the gash. It served his features well. "What happened?" she asked. Setting down their injured companion, Arvag answered, "The dragon heard us, heard or smelled, I know not which. But when we drew near, he lifted his tail and dropped it upon us. The four of us barely escaped being crushed. The others..." He shook his head. "We could not reach their bodies." Then Ilgra bent her neck with sorrow, mourning their deaths. She hoped their spirits might some day find safe passage to the afterlife. What remained of the warband was somber indeed, as they started back through the dark and the rain. When they arrived at the Hall of Jar, Arvag gave the clan a full accounting of their expedition, and the Herndal decided they would not trouble Vermund the Grim again, not until or unless they had a better plan for ridding themselves of the cunning old worm. Ilgra hated the decision, but having no suggestion of her own, she held her tongue. The oldest of the Herndal, Elgar Ninefingers, then said, "We are fortunate you did not anger Vermund such that he came seeking after us. But we should not rest easy. Dragons have long memories and are slow to forgive. It is known." And all agreed. Later still, when she sat with her mother and sister, Ildra showed them the horn she had cut from her father's head. As eldest heir, the horn was hers to keep, but Yana touched it and said, "I am glad you did this." And Ilgra saw tears in her eyes, and she knew then the measure of her sister's grief, and it was no less than her own. Days passed. In that time, the clan did their best to ignore the dragon perched atop Kulkaris. Instead, they tracked and captured the livestock that had survived the attack. They saved what seeds and materials they could. And one by one, those of the Skagaro who still had halls intact enough to ward off the weather began to return to the village. Ilgra's father had been a good hunter and a speaker of truths for the anointed, a position of no small importance. With him now gone and their home destroyed, Ilgra and her family had no choice but to take refuge in the Hall of Bajqua, brother to her mother,
and much like her in make and temperament. It rankled Ilgrid that they needed to depend on Bajqua's generosity, but their choices were limited, and they were lucky not to be stuck living with Jar, who always smelled of fish. In the evenings, when she was free, Ilgra took her father's horn to a stream and soaked it in the swift-flowing current. When the marrow of the horn was soft, she scraped it out and smoothed the inside with heated stones until it was slick as shell. Then she gave the horn to Darvik, and he carved a mouthpiece from the thigh-bone of a bear, scribed the woven pattern of their family history around the belled end, and last of all, knotted a leather-carrying strap round the middle. When it was finished, an expanse of wonder broadened Dilgra's heart. She put her lips to the mouthpiece and sounded the horn with a mighty breath. A brazen note rang forth, loud and deep-throated, a challenge to all who might oppose her. In it, Dilgra heard an echo of her father's voice, and a sorrowful joy filled her eyes with tears. A fortnight after Vermund's bloody reaving, a wandering shaman came to them from the south. The shaman was short, but thick in every measure, and his horns curled twice around his ears. His name was Ulkro, and he carried a staff cut with runes and with a single sapphire, large as his thumb, set within the knotted wood. He claimed to have heard of Vermund and said that he, Ulkro, could kill the dragon. Ilgra listened with resentment. If anyone were to kill Vermund the Grim, it ought to be her. But it was a selfish desire, so she spoke of it not. The shaman frightened her. He passed his staff through the hall fire and made the flames dance at his command. She did not understand magic. She put her trust in bone and muscle, not words and potions. The next morning, Ulkro set forth to climb Kulkaris and confront the dragon. The whole clan turned out to watch, a silent gathering of hard-eyed faces, too racked with sorrow to cheer or hope. Ulkro made up for their quiet with japes and jibes and shows of magic. He finished with a bolt of lightning from his staff, with which he split a sapling, sending it tumbling to the ground. At that, the clan broke their stillness and gave full voice to a war chant as the shaman made his departure. That evening, when the sun streamed low across the mountain peaks and the valley lay in purple shadow, Ilgra heard a roar from Vermund. Fear struck through her, and she and her family rushed outside, as did the rest of Clan Skagaro. Upon high Kulkaris they saw the giant worm spread his coal-black wings and rise up rampant before the amber sky. His head was wreathed with flashes of light, and fire burst from his maw, an angry banner that rippled as if in a beating gale. Shadows clung round the dragon, unnatural in the extreme, and slabs of stone split off the face of Kulkaris and fell to shatter against the trees below. Whatever else could be said of the shaman Ulkro, he was neither coward nor weakling, and his magics served him well. For a fraught span the battle raged fierce and ferocious. Then the hollow shriek of the death bird sounded among the trees, and a flare of red light went up from Kulkaris. A great beacon bright enough to pierce the gathered clouds and breach the heavens beyond. A moment later the light vanished. They heard Vermund utter a triumphant bellow, and then all was still, and all was quiet. At dawn's first light, Ilgra crept out with the warriors, fearful to see what Ulkro had wrought. They turned their gazes northward, and there, upon the peak of Kulkaris, the scaled length of Vermund again coiled around the jagged rock, seemingly unperturbed by the night's events. Ilgra felt the grey leech of hopelessness, and she looked at Gorgoth her spear, and wondered what hope she had of ever defeating the dragon Vermund. It was not in her nature to give